listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove, LNG. This slideshow depicts part two of Barbara Bernstein's radio documentary series, Holding the Thin Green Line, which explores what is at stake in Southern Oregon if the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline get built. From July 27th to the 31st, this slideshow video can be viewed at your own convenience at holdingthethingreenline.org/Jordan Cove Slideshow. Then on July 31st from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with impacted landowners, community organizers, and land and water protectors who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG documentary slideshow screening, July 27th to the 31st, and a live on Zoom Q&A on July 31st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, 150,000 Americans have now died from the COVID-19 virus in the United States. With more than 4.3 million people infected, the grim milestone came at the same time that 21 states entered the so-called red zone of emergency, as per federal government standards for rising death rates. Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force coordinator, remarked on Tuesday that, quote, "We can see the virus moving north. What we're seeing across the South right now is both rural infections as well as small metros and major metros simultaneously." The New York Times surveyed every four-year college and university in the U.S. and estimated that 6,300 COVID-19 cases have been linked to about 270 campuses, offering a sobering warning to in-person instruction resuming in the fall. On Tuesday, Democratic lawmakers wrote to Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, demanding to know if the White House improperly pressured her to reopen K-12 schools based on political considerations. And the American Federation of Teachers announced to its membership that it would support so-called safety strikes by teachers who were being forced to return to schools. Republican Congressman Louie Gohmert has tested positive for COVID-19 during routine White House screenings ahead of a scheduled meeting with President Donald Trump. Gohmert had been going about business as usual and had been refusing to wear a mask. He even attended Tuesday's hearing with Attorney General William Barr without a mask on. Meanwhile, two employees of a Trader Joe's grocery store in Manhattan reportedly were targeted by a pair of mask-refusing customers with violence. One ended up in the hospital. The offenders were arrested and charged. President Trump is upset that Dr. Anthony Fauci's approval ratings are higher than his. And rather than focus on the mounting death toll, he told reporters, quote, "He's got this high approval rating. Why don't I have a high approval rating?" Reporters have been asking Trump about a video that he tweeted earlier this week that was so full of misinformation that social media platforms deleted them. The videos featured a group of Trump-linked doctors, including a Houston-based pediatrician named Dr. Stella Emanuel, whose controversial claims include linking gynecological conditions to intercourse with demons. In the videos, Trump and others tweeted, Dr. Emanuel promoted Trump's favorite drug, hydroxychloroquine. This is how the president responded to questions about it on Tuesday.
I was very impressed with her and other doctors that stood with her. I think she may dent, but I know nothing about it. I just saw her on, making a statement with very respected doctors.
That's Trump saying how impressed he was with a controversial doctor whose misinformation-filled video he had tweeted. The physician in question says she's part of a group called America's Frontline Doctors that has gained a following online after the extremist right-wing website Breitbart live-streamed their press conference. Huffington Post has revealed that, quote, a conservative dark money group is behind the press event, and that event was organized, quote, by Tea Party Patriots, a wealthy Republican donor-backed nonprofit that, in partnership with FreedomWorks and other right-wing dark money groups, launched the Save Our Country Coalition in April to push for America's rapid reopening. The founder of America's Frontline Doctors is a frequent guest on Fox News. Meanwhile, after Facebook, Twitter, and Google pulled the video of the press conference from their platforms, Fox host Tucker Carlson aired clips of it on his show. So widespread are COVID-19 conspiracy theories now that even pop star Madonna on Tuesday posted the same video to her Instagram account, saying, quote, "The truth will set us all free, but some people don't want to hear the truth." Associated Press is reporting that, quote, U.S. officials say Russian intelligence officers are spreading disinformation about the coronavirus pandemic through English-language websites. Senate Republicans continue to drag their feet on passing a new COVID relief bill, unable to come to agreement on jobless benefits and other details. Republicans want to reduce the $600 a week in benefits that millions of unemployed Americans have been getting and that are about to expire. Trump, who's been carrying out a vendetta against Democratic-run liberal cities, has totally rejected aid for such cities to be included in the package. And Republicans are at odds with Trump over the inclusion of funds to build a new FBI headquarters in the bill near a Trump hotel in D.C. The state of California is considering extending the $600 in benefits for jobless Americans if the federal government pulls funding. Meanwhile, a federal moratorium on evictions has just expired on the eve of August rents being due, threatening to push millions of Americans out of their rental homes. The Small Business Administration's Inspector General's Office has announced that the government's Economic Injury Disaster Loan, or EIDL, program has been the target of fraud. The Wall Street Journal reports that there have been, quote, more than 5,000 complaints of suspected fraud from lenders. The EIDL program is separate from the Paycheck Protection Program. Reuters is reporting that, quote, small businesses face mass closures without more pandemic aid, and that many small businesses nationwide are reaching breaking points. The CEOs of the four biggest tech companies in the U.S. appeared together at a congressional hearing for the first time on Wednesday. Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Tim Cook of Apple, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, and Sundar Pichai of Google made their case to lawmakers that there's no need for government regulation and that they already face stiff competition. This is Mr. Bezos at the All Digital hearing.
The retail market we participate in is extraordinarily large and competitive. Amazon accounts for less than 1% of the $25 trillion global retail market and less than 4% of U.S. retail. There's room in retail for multiple winners. We compete against large, established players like Target, Costco, Kroger, and of course, Walmart, a company more than twice Amazon's size. 20 years ago, we made the decision to invite other sellers to sell in our store to share the same valuable real estate we spent billions to build, market, and maintain.
Jeff Bezos is the world's richest man and recently made headlines for making $13 billion of income in a single day. Ahead of the big tech testimonies to the congressional panel that oversees antitrust laws, reports emerged of the Democrats on that committee having received large campaign donations from the companies that the testifying CEOs represent. In news from Portland, Oregon, where federal agents have been violently attacking protesters, talks are apparently underway for a phased withdrawal as a result of negotiations between the White House and Oregon Governor Kate Brown. And Jenny Durkin, the mayor of Seattle, Washington, tweeted that she was informed by Homeland Security that, quote, federal forces deployed to Seattle have demobilized and left. A new Reuters Ipsos poll found that support for the Black Lives Matter movement has somewhat fallen, but there is widespread disapproval of Trump's tactics to deploy federal agents to cities like Portland. Finally, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has said that he would announce his much-anticipated choice of a running mate next week. A photographer captured handwritten notes in Biden's hands referring to Senator Kamala Harris, fueling rumors that Harris is the VP pick. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. U.S. Attorney General William Barr on Tuesday testified at a remarkably caustic House Judiciary Committee hearing, appearing before lawmakers for the first time in a year. Barr, who has been accused of politicizing the Justice Department like no other AG in recent memory, faced angry Democrats who accused him of mischaracterizing peaceful protesters as violent rioters and of justifying the deployment of federal officers in cities like Portland. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal in particular challenged Barr on taking a hypocritical stance, ignoring law-breaking Trump supporters while targeting liberal activists and the public. My guest is Marjorie Cohn. She's a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's also a writer for Truth Out. We had spoken with her just a year and a half ago when Barr was first confirmed as Trump's attorney general, and she's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, Marjorie.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So I mentioned that the Pramila Jayapal exchange was quite remarkable, and I want to play this for our audience because I thought it was just such a cleverly and succinctly expressed way in which she exposed Barr's hypocrisy, and then we'll get your response.
On two separate occasions, after President Trump tweeted, "Liberate Michigan," to subvert stay-home orders to protect the public health of people in Michigan, protesters swarmed the Michigan Capitol carrying guns, some with swastikas, Confederate flags, and one even with a dark-haired doll with a noose around its neck. Are you aware that these protesters called for the governor to be lynched, shot, and beheaded?
No.
You're not aware of that?
I was not aware.
Major protests in Michigan, you're the attorney general, and you didn't know that the protesters called for the governor to be lynched, shot, and beheaded. So well, obviously you couldn't be concerned about that.
Well, there are a lot of protests around the United States. And on June
Attorney
1st,
General Barr,
I was worried about the District of Columbia, which is federal.
Protests in certain parts of the country, you're very aware of those. But when protesters with guns and swastikas
I'm very,
and
I am aware of,
flags,
of
excuse me, Mr. Barr,
the federal
this is
government.
My time, and I control it. You are aware of certain kinds of protesters, but in Michigan, when protesters carry guns and Confederate flags and swastikas and call for the governor of Michigan to be beheaded and shot and lynched, somehow you're not aware of that. Somehow you didn't know about it, so you didn't send federal agents in to do to the president's supporters what you did to the president's protesters. In fact, you didn't put pepper balls on those protesters. So the point I'm trying to make here, Mr. Barr, that I think is very important for the country to understand, is that there is a real discrepancy in how you react as the attorney general, the top cop in this country, when white men with swastikas storm a government building with guns. There is no need for the president to, quote, activate you because they're getting the president's personal agenda done. But when black people and people of color protest police brutality, systemic racism, and the president's very own lack of response to those critical issues, then you forcibly remove them with armed federal officers, pepper bombs, because they are considered terrorists by the president.
And that is Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal at the congressional hearing on Tuesday, confronting Attorney General William Barr. Marjorie Cohn is my guest. Marjorie, what did you make of this?
Well, Donald Trump didn't just tolerate the Michigan protests. He incited them with two separate tweets. And how could Barr not be aware of this? Barr shares Donald Trump's claim of total executive power. In fact, in a 2018 memo, which turned out to be a job application for Attorney General, Barr wrote, his theory is the unitary executive, like John Yoo, who happens to be advising Donald Trump. John Yoo was one of the most infamous torture lawyers during the Bush administration. And this unitary executive theory, which is a marginal theory, says that the president has complete power over the entire executive branch, all law enforcement, including over his own conduct and things, matters in which he has a personal stake. So I don't buy it that Barr didn't know about this. Trump didn't just, Trump actually incited it.
So the way in which Jayapal essentially brought up this hypocrisy, I thought was really important, because she brought up the racial dynamics of this moment that we're in today, a multiracial uprising protesting racist police violence gets characterized as violent anarchists, rioters, Antifa, you name it, and get the full force of the federal government, whereas white supremacist Trump-supporting anti-lockdown protesters who are coming armed, and some of whom are targeting the Black Lives Matter protests, are not even on the radar of the Justice Department, because, of course, this is extremely partisan. This one instance seems to show that, as many have pointed out, Barr is essentially acting as Trump's personal lawyer, right?
Yes, he is, the way Jeff Sessions did not do when he recused himself from the Mueller investigation, and he was punished. He was fired as Attorney General, and now he can't even get his old Senate seat back, which is interesting. But this hypocrisy on the part of the Trump administration, Trump and Barr, his right-hand man, his prostitute-in-chief, shows where Trump's priorities are, and they are to protect the white racists and to go after people of color and their allies. And that was true from day one when he came down that escalator and called Mexicans criminals and rapists. And in fact, Trump isn't even bothering to go to Washington for John Lewis's funeral. That says it all.
Right. In fact, when he was asked about attending Lewis's funeral or even just paying his respects while his body lay in state, he said, nope, I wouldn't be going. And he had a previous run-in with Lewis in the early part of his presidency. I want to play another clip from the hearing on Tuesday with Bill Barr. This is Representative Cicilline asking about the tear gassing of protesters.
Do you think it's ever appropriate to use tear gas on peaceful protesters? Yes or no?
Well, the problem in these things sometimes occur because it's hard to separate people who...
Mr. Barr, my question is very specific. Do you think it is ever appropriate to use tear gas on peaceful protesters?
It is,
yes or no?
It is appropriate to use tear gas when it's indicated to disperse...
On peaceful protesters?
To disperse an unlawful assembly, and sometimes, sir, unfortunately, peaceful protesters are affected by it.
Okay.
William Barr, unable to answer with a yes or no whether it's appropriate to use tear gas on peaceful protesters. Marjorie Cohn, it seems as though the Attorney General does not understand the meaning of the First Amendment.
Well, this is not surprising, Sonali, because during the George W. Bush administration, Barr said that suspected terrorists were not protected by the Geneva Conventions. In other words, they could be tortured and subjected to cruel treatment. Of course, the Supreme Court made very clear that Barr was wrong. But Barr did not say outright that you can't use chemical weapons on peaceful protesters. Tear gas is banned in warfare internationally, but under the Chemical Weapons Convention, there's an exception for domestic riot control. And that's why you see just before these federal goons that are deploying to different cities around the country, just before they go in and start using chemical weapons and dangerous projectiles against peaceful protesters, they declare a riot. You'll see that in the news coverage. The police declared a riot. The federal agents declared a riot. And that's so they can squeeze themselves into this exception in the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. And of course, it was interesting on the same day, I don't know if you heard, but there was an Army National Guardsman who testified around the clearing of peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square on June 1st, just before Trump's church front photo op. And he basically said that those protesters had done nothing to provoke the tear gassing and the attack on them. And that was right at the sort of beginning of the George Floyd related protests. So I don't know if they invoked the idea of a riot in that instance as well, but it just is, it's pretty amazing to see these instances that armed right-wing militias have been warning us about for years, right, Marjorie? We see NRA folks saying we need to arm ourselves to the teeth because of the potential of government tyranny unleashing the military on its own citizens. Well, it's happening right now, and they don't seem to notice or care.
Well, the armed power of the state is not being, and the feds, is not being marshaled against the right-wingers. That's why we're not hearing any pushback. Right. Them. It's being marshaled against Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, and people of color and their allies.
Is this sort of revenge, if you will, for the exposing of police departments? Trump has courted police, and now that police are under attack, it seems as though the deployment of federal officers is a way to say to police, we've got your back.
Well, I also think, Sonali, that he's sending in the feds and using the excuse, and I think it's a false one, that the local police departments are not protecting federal property. And you're talking about the federal courthouse in Portland, which he says, has Barr said, has been under siege every night for 2 months, which is false. He refused to say from the get-go that it was inappropriate to use chemical weapons and break the bones of this peaceful Navy veteran who was exercising his right to free speech. And Barr went on to say that the inspector general was reviewing it, so I really can't say. Well, the reason that the inspector general, each federal agency has an inspector general, a neutral watchdog, an independent watchdog, to review the activities of that agency. And the reason that the inspectors general of the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security are reviewing whether or not there were violations of the law in these federal agents basically interfering with the First Amendment rights of these protesters, that was the charge. The request that the chairs of the House Judiciary and Oversight and Reform and Homeland Security committees asked the inspectors general in the Department of Justice and Homeland Security to do an investigation, and the inspectors general agreed. And so now Barr is saying, oh, the inspectors general are investigating it. He's using that as an excuse. I am anxious to see what the inspectors general turn up, because there has been massive law breaking, violations of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, which I've written about recently, with Trump's federal agents. And you notice, Sonali, he didn't send in the military. The military, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, has a duty to obey lawful orders and a duty to disobey unlawful orders. And so I think he's concerned that they might not obey these orders to crack the heads and use chemical weapons on peaceful protesters. But the Customs and Border Protection are pro-Trump, they're very right-wing, and he knows that they and the Department of Homeland Security agents are going to do his bidding. And I think that's why we see these federal goons going into various various cities and not the military.
So let's play another clip of this of Jerry Nadler, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, who pointedly asked about whether there was any collusion between Barr and Trump when it came to the deployment of federal agents in Portland, because, of course, many suspect that this is all a political show of force to fuel Trump's re-election campaign. Here is a clip of that exchange.
Yes or no? Have you discussed the president's re-election campaign with the president or with any White House official or any surrogate of the president?
Well, I'm not going to get into my discussions with the president.
Well, have you discussed that topic with him, yes or no?
Not in relation to this program.
I didn't ask that. I asked if you discussed that.
I'm a member of the cabinet, and there's an election going on. Obviously, the topic comes up.
So the answer is yes.
Well, the topic comes up in cabinet meetings and other things. It shouldn't be a surprise that the topic of the election.
I didn't say I was surprised. I just asked if you'd done that. So as part of those conversations with the president or his people about the re-election campaign, have you ever discussed the current or future deployment of federal law enforcement?
In connection with what?
In connection with what you just said, in connection with the with your discussions with the president or with other people around him of his re-election campaign, have you discussed the current or future deployment of federal law enforcement?
Well, as I say, I'm not going to get into my discussions with the president, but I've made it clear that I would like to pick the cities based on law enforcement need and based on neutral criteria.
But you can't tell me whether you discussed...
No, I'm not going to discuss what I discussed with the president.
Can you commit today that the department will not use federal law enforcement as a prop in the president's re-election campaign?
We are not using federal
law enforcement. I just want to close with this thought. You really can't hide behind legal fictions this time, Mr. Barr. It's all out in the open, where the people can see what you are doing for themselves. The president wants footage for his campaign ads, and you appear to be serving it up to him as ordered.
And that is Congressman Jerry Nadler confronting William Barr. Marjorie Cohn, do you think that it's fairly obvious that Barr is, you know, sort of serving the Trump re-election campaign? And were you surprised by Barr just straight out saying, I'm not going to reveal what I privately discussed with the president?
Well, I think he's clearly helping Trump to get reelected, and so he's really politicizing the office of the Attorney General. The Attorney General is the Attorney General of the United States, not of the president, and yet the president was very upset, as I said, when Sessions was not doing his bidding. Barr wouldn't say that he didn't discuss this with Donald Trump. He also said at one point in the hearing that Donald Trump he didn't use the word micromanaging, but Donald Trump trusted him to do whatever he wanted. And that's because Donald Trump knows that Barr has his back. A year and a half ago, when Barr was first appointed and you and I spoke, I wrote a piece for Truthout, and it was called William Barr Will Be a Loyal Foot Soldier in King Trump's Army. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what has happened. It was Barr who ordered the chemical weapons to be used against the peaceful protesters on June the 1st in Washington, D.C., to clear the way for Trump's cynical photo op in front of the church holding a Bible.
So for the Democrats to sort of point this out, it's I don't know how much of it is actually going to be heard by Americans, but it does seem that Trump is trying to give the impression that crime is going to rise in Biden's America, and therefore he is the law and order president. There was a recent ad that his campaign put out showing this, you know, elderly white woman watching television and watching Black Lives Matter protesters demand the defunding of police. And then there's an intruder at her door and she's calling 911, but no one's answering because apparently the police have all been defunded as of the emergency responders. And we're left to imagine what this intruder does to this vulnerable woman. And it ends with, you know, Trump's campaign slogan of, well, this is what you get under Biden's America. But of course, if crime is indeed rising in America, it's rising under Trump's regime, right?
Absolutely. And Trump is really, really freaked out that his poll numbers are so low, thanks to his criminal mismanagement and denial of the coronavirus pandemic for months. He did nothing, and now it's worse than nothing what he's doing. I hold him personally responsible for tens of thousands of deaths, and apparently so do many Americans if the polls are to be believed. And so in his desperation, he is trying to create these video clips of chaos in various cities so that he can play those like you, the commercial you cited, to try to rile up his base, scare the hell out of them, and they need a strong law and order president, a la Richard Nixon, who ran on a law and order platform as well. The problem is that Donald Trump doesn't obey the law, and his federal goons are creating disorder. So it's really one more of Trump's horrific lies at the expense of the American people.
I want to play one last clip of the hearing that Barr was featured at, where he once more seemed to struggle to answer a pretty direct question, this time about the issue of foreign assistance in an election.
Is it ever appropriate, sir, for the president to solicit or accept foreign assistance in an election?
It depends what kind of assistance.
Is it ever appropriate for the president or presidential candidate to accept or solicit foreign assistance of any kind in his or her election?
No, it's not appropriate.
Okay, sorry you had to struggle with that one, Mr. Attorney General.
Marjorie Cohn, what did you make of that? I was kind of shocked that he said depends on what kind of assistance.
He sounded like a Trump apologist testifying during the impeachment hearings. The House of Representatives of the United States impeached Donald Trump for soliciting assistance from Ukraine to investigate Biden, whom Trump correctly identified as his ultimate opponent. This is patently illegal. The GOP-led Senate Intelligence Committee unanimously found that Russia interfered in the elections, and it took Barr quite a while, actually. He had to be asked the question again before he finally said, no, it's not appropriate. Barr, of all people, the top cop in the United States, should know the law, which is that foreign assistance in elections is never allowed, and solicitation of foreign assistance for purposes of U.S. interfering in U.S. elections is absolutely verboten. And so he is really Trump's prostitute here, and I don't mean to besmirch prostitutes, but he is doing Trump's bidding, so much so that Trump trusts him implicitly to watch his back, and it's really an outrage given the fact that he's the Attorney General of the United States.
Finally, Marjorie, do you think Barr will ever be held accountable? I mean, there was some talk earlier this year of impeaching Barr, but it just seems as though, given everything that's happening in the country, that Democrats are loath to pursue this because of how the impeachment of Trump ended up going.
Yes, it's hard to say ultimately if the Democrats win the presidential election and the Democrats take back the Senate, then they have a clear path to do what they want and get these 200 plus pieces of legislation through that are sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk. I just don't know at that point whether the Democrats will have the stomach to impeach Barr. But boy, if anybody should be impeached, it's William Barr. He deserves it.
Marjorie, thanks as always for joining us today. I always appreciate your insight.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's also a writer for Truthout. We've been discussing William Barr's congressional testimony on Tuesday. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has prided himself on promoting the concept of religious liberty as part of his presidency. His administration has privileged religious groups, and a conservative-leaning Supreme Court has affirmed that push. Indeed, the U.S. Constitution offers strong protections for religious freedom. But it turns out that not all religions seem to enjoy constitutional protections and the legal precedents equally. Unsurprisingly, the religious demands, practices, and beliefs of white Christians dominate the American landscape. Examining the history of how this has come to be in a new book is my guest, Kiyathi Joshi. She's a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, author of New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America, and co-editor of Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice, the third edition. Her book is called White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. Welcome to the program, Kiyathi.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
So you write in your book using this term that I hadn't really heard before, but I think is a really useful place to start, which is Christian normativity. Tell me what you mean by that. I'm assuming that it's sort of how when we talk about race, how whiteness is considered quote unquote normal.
Yeah, it's really about how Christian ways, Christian language, Christian ways of believing, Christian ways of worshiping are just considered normal, right? So for example, the way that when the media talks about prayer or somebody's talking about prayer, prayer is, you know, sitting in a pew, hands folded, you know, head bowed, perhaps. It's not necessarily, one doesn't conjure up the image of my parents at the Hindu temple prostrating themselves in front of the deities, you know. So it is really about how Christian ways become the normal way of doing things. And that really does put religious minority groups at a disadvantage.
So let's talk about history, because that's your book focuses primarily on that. Where do you start the story of how Christian normativity began in the United States, where the religion of white Christians and their beliefs really laid the groundwork for the country?
So the one thing I'll say is the book focuses a lot on history and law. And then I also talk about what it looks like today and what are the ramifications. So I would want your listeners and viewers to know that it's not just a history book. That's really important. But to answer your question, we can't talk about religious freedom and the First Amendment and without talking about really race also. One of the arguments I have in the book is that actually race and religion, whiteness and Christianity, kind of go hand in hand. And Christianity has had a huge role in the construction of white supremacy, in the construction of racism. So really, we have to go back to the Iberian Peninsula in 1400s, Spain and Portugal, and see how religion became racialized with what happened with Jews and Muslims at the time called the Moors there, and what happened because you had a group who were conversos, who like Jews who converted, for example, and Moriscos was the term given to Muslims who converted. But here's the thing, Sonali, they were really never considered real Christians, because it was believed that to be Jewish was in the blood, or to be Muslim was in the blood. This, now we're going to fast forward a couple of centuries, and we see religion morphing into our modern concept of race. Our modern concept of race really comes about in the 1500s with all of this. And before we talk about black and white in history, we have the language of civilized and uncivilized, and we have the language of Christian and heathen. And so the Native Americans were uncivilized and not Christian. They were heathens and got put into a category. Africans who were enslaved and brought to the Western Hemisphere were not Christian necessarily. Some could have been. And they were not European. They were not white. So they were, of course, you know, to say they were marginalized is putting it lightly and not doing it justice. But I'm trying to make the point of how these terms go together. And then we ultimately see this even with what happens with Hispanic and Asian groups. And I go into a fair amount of detail around Hispanic and Asian groups because I focus on immigration and citizenship in the 1800s and into the 20th century on how race and religion, whiteness and Christianity went together to create groups who were othered.
So let's talk about non-white Christians, because this is an important aspect of it. I mean, white Christian extremists in the United States might not be very aware of the fact that there are non-white Christians all over the world, including in predominantly Muslim countries or predominantly Hindu countries or etc. Barack Obama was a non-white Christian, and you write about him in your book. How did Obama confound the white Christian extremist base that, you know, ended up supporting a president like Trump? They desperately wanted to identify his middle name, Hussein, which was, of course, an identifier of an ancestry that was Muslim.
That's right. That's right. Actually, President Obama is how I start the section of the book when I'm talking about citizenship, because what he had to endure in terms of his citizenship being questioned, his patriotism being questioned, was just terrible, was just ridiculous. But yeah, there's four points to look at there. Number one is the fact that he was his middle name, as you brought up, right? Then there is the issue of his father. His father was not born in the United States. His father was not a U.S. citizen. His father was from Kenya. And the media, especially the conservative media that wanted to portray President Obama as not American, would often show, in some cases, we're not sure if they were really even his relatives in Kenya, but just to show almost the backwardness of Africans. And it was very horrible, and it was incredibly stereotypical, biased, and discriminatory. Then there was the issue that President Obama had spent time in Asia during his growing up years, right? And Asians have often been thought of as forever foreigner. You know, gosh, they're never, you know, we, I should say, as an Asian American, we're never gonna fit in. We're often seen from over there. And then finally, the fact that, you know, he would often say, oh, like, I go to church. But he went to a church where a pastor practiced liberation theology. This was not the kind of church that white Christian Americans go to. Therefore, it was unfamiliar territory to them. And that became an issue. So there were so many ways, and unfortunately he provides the perfect illustration to talk about citizenship in a variety of ways. But we can see exactly the way, if you take those four pathways, the number of ways that people in America are shown to be not American and, you know, constantly othered.
So the United States is supposed to be a secular country that still respects religious freedoms and respects the fact that there are, you know, many religions and that people's religious beliefs do need to be respected, but there is supposed to be a separation between church and state. So what does the Constitution actually say? Because that's important for us to think about when we look at how different religions might be treated differently. What does the Constitution actually say about the practice of religion and how it enters into the conversation?
Well, we have in the First Amendment, the religion clause is broken up into two clauses, the free exercise clause and the establishment clause. And basically one keeps government out of religion and the other one keeps religion out of government. All right. The whole phrase separation of church and state is nowhere in any of America's founding documents. That was actually written in a letter by Thomas Jefferson to a congregation, that phrase has become part of popular culture, if you will, because the Supreme Court used it in one of their decisions on separating, taking prayer and the reading of the Bible out of school. Okay, and that's another important thing. In the 50s and the 60s, we had cases that took prayer and the reading of the Bible out of school. It didn't take religion out of school, but that got understood as government taking religion out of school. And that's actually one of the reasons we're in the pickle we're in today, because we don't learn about different religions in school most of the time in US public schools. And I would say that even sometimes so many world events are taught where we don't have a proper understanding of how religion has influenced those historical events. So you can't really get the whole story, and that's something that really needs to change.
So you talk about how the Christian practice of religion as being a little bit different from when some other religions practice is also interwoven into legal precedents. You write that, because often Christians engage in or their faith is shaped by their belief rather than certain practices. They may go to church, but really it's their beliefs in, say, Jesus Christ, as opposed to, say, a Muslim whose practices of maybe wearing a hijab or not eating pork. Those differences are manifest in the laws that protect religious minorities. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, and that really shows the Christian hegemony that exists, right? The way, and when I say Christian hegemony, what that's referring to really is just the way that Christianity is in all the nooks and crevices, nooks and crannies of laws, okay? And also our culture. So for example, in Christian faiths, there is no requirement of a head covering so that when Jews who are observant, men who wear kippah, or Sikhs who wear turbans, or Muslim women who wear hijab, when they want to do certain things and keep their head covering, it has become an issue. Jews and Sikhs have had to fight to be in the military, to be in the military to be able to practice their faith. Engage in their, wear the head covering like they are supposed to by their religion, as they believe it to be, and still serve, right? We have so many cases of Sikh men wanting to serve as police officers, and it's often lawsuits on a case-by-case basis. If we actually had, if Christian denominations had something in the religion that said, you must have a head covering, this would not be an issue for other religions.
Right. So we imagine that today all religions are allowed to practice freely, that even if white Christianity formed the underpinnings of the origins of this country, that today it's all about religious liberty. And indeed, the Trump administration uses that term religious liberty a lot. It's even something that they promote internationally. State Secretary Mike Pompeo has talked about it quite a bit. He's, someone who's seems to be driven by his Christian religious beliefs. So they talk about religious liberty a lot, but they're generally talking about Christianity, right? Because I imagine oftentimes when they have photo ops, when Trump and his cabinet have photo ops with Christian leaders, you wouldn't, never imagine seeing them having similar photo ops with, say, primarily Muslim groups, or the same kinds of privileges that they fight for Christian groups to have if it was a Muslim organization or a Muslim person at a bakery who didn't want to bake a cake for a gay couple, that you wouldn't see the right-wing groups fighting for that religious, minority.
Well, Sonali, we can hope, right? We could hope, but you're absolutely right. And you know what I'll say is that the religious right and the conservative segment of Christian America, they are very good at messaging. And they are very good at marketing their ideas. So they have co-opted this idea of religious liberty and religious freedom. So what do they say? They will often say that we are the ones persecuted because we are not allowed to be show our faith and practice freely because people judge us. Now, I want to be clear that I do think there is a bias against religion in this country in certain segments of America. And I would say, for example, at colleges and universities, I would say we have one.
How so?
Well, you know, if you're religious, and I'll say honestly here, not just Christian, but other religious backgrounds out there. Also, if you're religious, you're kind of looked at a little differently, you know, because it's almost like folks who are intellectual maybe should know better. And that's unfortunate.
Are you talking about in academia, that there's a bias against academics who are religious?
I'm talking about the idea of being religious in academia. There are biases there. And so I'm not saying that someone who isn't evangelical, hasn't faced discrimination, like by somebody said something to them or whatever, maybe because they were praying or something like that. But they don't have the institutional support behind them, because Christianity is infused in our public policy, in our laws and Supreme Court decisions. So the idea that they have to fight for religious freedom is a farce. It is an absolute farce. But I did want to kind of, you know, nuance the argument a little bit and talk about the fact that in reality, we do know that there is an anti-religion sentiment in segments of our society.
Well, I'm not quite sure about that, but I want to talk to you about immigration policy. You mentioned earlier that there is a very intimate relationship between Christianity and whiteness. Of course, the issue of race comes into it deeply. Your book is called White Christian Privilege, not Christian Privilege. How have our immigration policies over the years privileged Christian immigrants and light-skinned Christian immigrants?
Yeah. So the two the two events I can bring up are both immigration laws that really tell the story very well. And one is the Immigration Act of 1917, which created a barred zone from Asia. So most of Asia, immigrants from most of Asia were barred from coming to the United States after 1917. Okay. Now, you have to think about what are the religious groups of the people who might have come. Let me be clear, the act, the law, says nothing about religion. All right. Then you have to look at what happened in 1924. We severely curtailed immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. Now, look at the religious backgrounds of those immigrants that would have arrived. They would have been predominantly Jewish, Catholic, and Eastern Orthodox. Okay, so 1917 shut the door. Imagine shutting the door. 1924, we close the door and kind of stick a foot in there to kind of keep it shimmied open. Okay, now it's almost like a mathematical equation. When you put 1917 together with 1924, you see that we are trying to create a white Protestant nation with the groups who are being excluded. And then we can fast forward to just a couple of years ago with the executive order signed by the current president in January of 2017, referred to as the Muslim ban. The exact number is escaping me right now. And that harks back immediately to what we did in 1917 with Asian immigrants. Again, the executive order doesn't say one word about religion, but the actual impact has a lot to do with the religious backgrounds of those refugees. and others coming in. So we have to apply, for those who are familiar with critical race theory, we have to apply that lens, which is you read the law, you see it, but then you have to understand the impact of it also in reality.
So today we have a right-wing extremist white Christian base that President Trump relies on for political power, who have also created this mythology about Sharia law creeping through America, ready to, you know, radicalize our children and cover our women with hijabs. This kind of fear mongering is very much linked to racism in America, right? I mean, this also seems to be something that you can characterize as white Christian privilege at work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have the racialization of religion, right? Which is where we see that, especially since 9/11, although it was happening actually since the, you know, Iran hostage crisis in 1979 and the issues with oil from the Middle East, that brown skin, having brown skin equals Islam, which means you're a terrorist, right? And you can't be trusted. You're questioned constantly. Your life's on the line, especially for men. So there's absolutely no question about the racialization of religion. And unfortunately, we live during a time, and we have leaders who are able to weaponize religion. They have weaponized Christianity to work against everyone else who's not Christian, further showing just how powerful Christianity is. When you think about the language we use, you know, American exceptionalism, right? This idea that we are this shining light, you know, and that we were to have this land from sea to shining sea, and it was ordained by God, all shows, it's full of Christian themes and prophecy, and that's what a group of Americans want today. They'd love it if people like you and me left.
Absolutely. We know that, many of us firsthand. So when we think about the way in which religion itself manifests in the United States, isn't it true that there are more and more Americans now who don't even identify with any particular religion? We're seeing sort of Pew Research showing that that more and more Americans are, you know, classifying themselves as none when it comes to asking what their religious beliefs are. And I'm wondering what you think that means.
That population is growing. And what I would say is that doesn't mean that folks aren't religious or spiritual. It's that they are choosing to not necessarily identify with an organized religion. So I don't think necessarily faith is going anywhere, or the way that religion guides people's moralities. You know, I think we also are seeing people picking up parts of faiths that speak to them, and then you can't categorize them, and they don't want to categorize them. But what is important,
and that's an interesting trend, just to interrupt you for a second, because of course eventually or ideally the issue of faith is a personal one. To have or even not have faith is a personal issue, and to see Americans moving in a direction where their faith or their beliefs become more individualistic and less part of, you know, big organized religion might actually mean a level of sophistication in American society that goes against the trend. It's unfortunately far too easy to see organized religion go toward, not all organized religion, but many times organized religions going toward down the path of fundamentalism, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Hinduism or even Buddhism, if you look at some parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I think though that even when we're talking about the unaffiliated population growing, you know, we're still going to have to work on and deal with white Christian privilege.
Well, Kiyathi Joshi, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
My guest has been Kiyoti Joshi. She's a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America, co-editor of Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice, third edition. We've been discussing her newest book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG.